And so it's going right down the line,
yep.
Right?
Yep.
Okay. I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2623.
Mr. Chair, committee members, House Bill 2623 retroactively eliminates break-in service provisions of the public employees retirement system as it outlined in ORS 238A025, which is the outlines OSSER, which is the new pension plan. And committee members, attached to your staff measure summary is some background information on break-in service for your reference.
Great. I'd like to call Don Loving, Marianne Guest, Rob Wagner, and Michael Dembro. Please. Well, squeeze up there. I guess only three of you can fit up there at once, so light it up.
Oh, okay.
Sorry.
What the heck?
So, go ahead and start whenever you're ready.
Okay, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Don Loving. I'm the Public Affairs Director for Oregon AFSCME. And, you know, the sun's out, spring training's well underway in Arizona and Florida. And in that light, I'm here sort of pinch-hitting for Mary Botkin, who is down talking about Department of Corrections issues. I am here representing both AFSCME and the PERS Coalition in supporting House Bill 2623, which, as you heard, would eliminate break and service provision from the PER statutes. As you're all well aware, your predecessors in 2003 passed several PERS reform bills. Some of those are still being sorted out in the court system. One relatively small piece of reform legislation, though, that continues to be a sticking point for everyone involved, employees and the PERS administration, is a piece that was really more an afterthought than anything when it was created, and that's break and service. It's been a pain in the neck and lower for countless public workers over the past 4 years. The old rules were very simple. You entered PERS prior to January 1st, 1996. You were Tier 1, provided you completed your five-year vesting. If you were after that, you were Tier 2. You could enter and leave the system at will for a variety of personal and family circumstances, and you kept your tier status. Break in service changed all that. Now, if you're out of the system for 6 months, you lose your original status as Tier 1 or 2, and you go into the new OPSERP thing, which, for whatever reason, nobody wants to call Tier 3, but that's really what it is. It's a Tier 3 with less benefits. Now, initially, there was not even an exception for those called to military duty by the federal government. That was fixed, at least in theory, although I'm going to talk about that in a second in some more detail. It gets even dicier legally. Employees who were wrongfully terminated can take 12 to 18 months to get back. Your committee has passed a bill that would fix issues like that, but again, unless it gets through and gets passed, that can still be a sticking point. So the big question here is, you know, why do we do this? And, of course, the answer was we thought we were going to save some money. That was the whole point behind break in service. There's a strong argument that that's not happening. Now, Mr. Delaney's here from PERS. I'm a huge Steve Delaney fan. He's like the old Shell answer man from the TV commercials. He knows everything. So he can explain to you how it will cost $600,000 initially if you eliminate break in service, but save them $250,000 every biennium into the future. How the employer rates have gone down 0.01% right now, but if you eliminate break in service, depending on how people retire, when they retire, if the moon is in its second house and Jupiter's aligned with Mars, everything else, that it could actually raise their rates by 0.04%. He can explain the details of that. What you know, an old country kid who grew up in Forest Grove can tell you is that if it's saving any money, it ain't the kind of money that is worth continuing with this. It causes headaches for PERS, employers, and employees. I know you may be thinking, well, we're going to have other bills that fix these issues as they come along. Yes and no. You know, every week or month, it seems like one of our staff union representatives comes up with some new nuance that involves break and service we haven't heard about before. We could be coming to you year after year with little things to fix with break and service, and it's simply not, it's just not worth it. Let me close with this. Every Friday, I put out a little legislative update to members of ours. This past Friday, I mentioned in there very casually that I would be here speaking to you folks today on Mary's behalf on this bill. Within 10 minutes when I hit send, I had a phone call from a person who works at DEQ who has been deployed to Iraq 2 times. He's in the Air National Guard and has 2 ongoing open disputed files with PERS that says he has a break in service. Now, you know, I explained to him, in fact, I'm giving Mr. Delaney his name and information, but I only bring him up to say that, you know, if that's happening with that employee on a, what's supposed to be a given with a break in service, you can just imagine what kind of headaches we're having with other people and other issues. So my final thoughts are this. Many of you ran on a platform that partially at least said, let's bring more efficiency to state government. Here's a great chance. I'm asking you to do the efficient thing here. Don't keep trying to fix every little nuance with break in service. Just get rid of it, and that would be a very efficient thing to do. I'll let Marianne speak, and then we would be happy to answer any questions.
Marianne, go ahead.
Thanks. Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Marianne Gaskell from the School Employees Association, and we support House Bill 2623. Oregon law allows an employee who is under PERS to be vested after 5 years of continued employment. And I looked it up this morning in Webster's Dictionary, and I thought, what does vested mean? Does it even have a definition anymore under the current PERS system? Vested means fully and unconditionally guaranteed as a legal right, benefit, or privilege. In the current break in service language in ORS 238.025, completely ignores the vested right of employees who may be under Tier 1 or 2. You know, you have exemptions. Don mentioned many exemptions you have for disabilities, for military service, for illness, for extended leave of absence. This committee just passed out a bill on a new exemption for folks that were terminated and then were reinstated later on. So, I mean, what we're going to do over the years, I think we'll continually bring you examples of why people should be exempted from break in service, but I think the best approach is just to eliminate break in service. It actually is right now an administrative nightmare, and you are harming folks that don't, you know, for whatever reason, never had vested rights in the system and no longer, with the break in service, now have to come into a different benefit level. I think it's just time to get rid of it. Thank you.
Well, before I open to questions, I just want to say I'm all for efficiency and I'm all for saving money, but certainly not on the backs of a worker who's already earned something, and then we take it away. That's why I voted no on all that stuff, and my vote's been vindicated halfway by the court. Remains to be seen. What I would like everybody testifying in favor of this to do today is get Mr. Delaney to run these numbers and see how much this is going to cost or not cost. And we don't need that today, but that, because if it costs a whole bunch of money to the program, I tell you, you got an uphill battle. Not that I don't think you're right, it's just I'm just one guy. With that, any questions? Representative Berger, please.
Yes, Mr. Chair, if I could comment, one of the things that pops into my brains is the fiscal on this and whether there's any subsequent referral to either Ways and Means or Revenue to talk about this fiscal impact, because this was part of the PERS package of reforms that were critically important at the time that they were put together, and I am strongly hesitant to just say, oh, let's start backing them off.
That's
and particularly without all the numbers in front of
us. That's very good. I couldn't agree more. Representative Escobar.
Yes, and I would like to add a little bit to that as looking at it two-way. One is that the people that have come back into the system since this has been passed, and two, the potential liability with people coming back into the system. It's a twofold look, and if that potential is too great, your Chair Schaffer is correct. It's going to be an uphill battle.
Any further questions or comments for these nice folks? All righty then. Thank you.
Thank you.
All right, now Rob Wagner and Michael Dembro. I forgot we only had three chairs up here.
It's a generational thing.
But whoever wants to go first.
Thank you. Chair Schaffler, for the record, my name is Rob Wagner. I'm the Director of Political and Legislative Affairs for the American Federation of Teachers here in Oregon. And I've got some just brief testimony, then I'll turn it over to Michael Dembro from Portland Community College here to testify on an instance in his situation that he's dealing with at his college, and some recent discussion that he's had with one of the authors of the PERS legislation. And I'll just to echo some of the comments that we heard from Don and from Marianne, the 2003 changes to PERS were very highly complex. There was a lot of discussion, as Representative Berger said, around this, and there was a rush at the end of the session, and we had some issues that had some really unintended consequences. And I'll give you an example. Last legislative session, in 2005, we came in with a bill. It was an omnibus bill, House Bill 2189, that corrected some of the issues that we had around faculty. There was a situation where there was a loophole, and there was hundreds of faculty potentially that were losing access to a retirement plan they had access to prior to the passage of the original House Bill 2003 in the 2003 session. And we were able to work through that process and get that corrected. And just to echo the comments that we've heard, the breaking service provision in this is an administrative nightmare. And I do think there is examples of broken promises. I submitted testimony from Bing Wong, who couldn't be here today. We call Bing CSI Bing, crime scene investigator. He's a forensic toxicologist, and he was with OHSU. A lot of folks probably know or met him over the years. And he worked up on Pill Hill for 21 years in 1996. His job was contracted out. And he actually had a discussion with a PERS representative at that time. And they said that if you're vested, you know, you would be able to come back in and keep your tier one status. Now there's some discussion about actually bringing forensic toxicology back in-house. So he's been out for a decade. He's tier one. He had 21 years in the system, and he's trying to do the balancing act of whether or not he stays with Kaiser Permanente, his current employer, or if he comes back, and you know he's trying to weigh all this out. But he went out on a promise, and so those are the sorts of issues that we're running into all the time with this. I mean, I can't tell you how many emails that we face from people who have lost a job and are concerned about their status. So, with that, I'll turn over to Michael Dembro from PCC to testify. Thank you.
Thank you. For the record, my name is Michael Dembro, and I am a faculty member at Portland Community College at the Cascade campus, where I've taught English for 25 years. And I am also the president of the Faculty Federation at Portland Community College and a vice president at AFT Oregon. And I've recently had the honor of being appointed to the State Board of Education as its first community college faculty advisor. I'm here today speaking on behalf of community college faculty who are being negatively affected by the break in service provisions of the existing PERS Act. And the, you know, as I see it, these provisions were probably, well, certainly well-intentioned, but they've had unintended consequences for many faculty around the state. And I want to talk to you about a couple of instances in which this is true. But first of all, let me say, as Rob mentioned, a couple of weeks ago I was at a town hall with Representative McPherson, and he was explaining to us the reason for the break in service provisions. And as he told us, the one of the main purposes of these provisions was to prevent employees from leaving Oregon public employment to try out careers in other areas, and then eventually to decide to come back and expect to have their Tier 1 status waiting for them. And his position was that that was unnecessary, and if people were leaving the system voluntarily, then they should be prepared, you know, for the consequences. But the situations that I'm talking about are cases in which people are leaving the system involuntarily for a brief, a limited period of time. First of all, we have faculty who are going on leaves of absence to pursue higher education. In some cases, these are people who are teaching in technical areas, whose background has been in their career fields, but they want to go back to school to actually get a master's degree in occupational education or something along those lines. These programs often last more than 1 year. Once they've gone beyond a year, for them to come back to the college, which they will do, they then are relegated to the officer system. They lose the Tier 1 status that they had. You need to know that they are pursuing this higher education entirely at their own expense. It's an unpaid leave of absence, and they're making considerable sacrifices to do it. It just seems unfair to, at the same time, expect them to make the further sacrifice of losing their Tier 1 status. We have two people who are in that situation right now. They weren't aware that they were facing these consequences, but I let them know about that. And it's very likely that they're going to give up their graduate programs. They're in the middle of their first year. They're going to have to decide very soon if they're going to come back for the second year. So I told them I would talk to you all and get you all to make this change so they can stay and do this work on behalf of the institution. The second group that's affected, and this is actually a more numerous group, are the part-time faculty who provide so much of the instruction in Oregon's community colleges and universities. We have a number of really hard-working people who've been providing instruction for many years. And under the PERS laws, if they are teaching half-time or more, they're PERS eligible. But if they drop below 50%, then they lose that eligibility. And, the situation that they're facing is if a class of theirs is canceled or if they are bumped because a full-timer's class is canceled, they can't fall below that 50% level. They will hopefully return to full employment, in the next academic year. But in the meantime, because of the break in service provisions, they lose the Tier 1 status that they, many of them have had for many years. So, when their class is canceled, when they go below half time, obviously it's a big loss of income for them. In addition, they're now going to lose their Tier 1 status. This really seems unfair and against the intent of the PERS reforms. I brought this up to Representative McPherson at the town hall, and he agreed that these were problems that ought to be corrected, and he encouraged me to pursue this issue. And that's why I'm really glad that I have the opportunity to speak about this problem with you today as you consider House Bill 2623. By removing the break in service provisions, HB 2623 would obviously solve this problem of unintended consequences, and so I would encourage you to support it. If you decide that you cannot drop them in their entirety, then I would strongly urge you to make sure that you address the issues, the kinds of situations that I've talked about, in a way that eliminates this unintended burden on faculty that punishes them really for working hard to do right by their institutions. So, Chair Schaffler and members of the committee, again, I want to thank you for allowing me to testify. I'd be happy to answer any questions you might have.
Well, before we open to questions, this bill today on the floor that I carried, I couldn't remember the bill number. My capable administrator here knew it. 2284 talks about breaks in service due to disciplinary action that can't be justified and other administrative reasons. I wonder if that falls under this other administrative reasons, or I don't know. I would go find out. Questions for these gentlemen? Representative Escobar.
When these people go away for their year or two to get their master's or PhD or whatever, do they not get a financial benefit from that when they come back?
No.
They don't? They don't get a pay raise or anything?
They don't. Not under our system. And I think, there are some colleges that do and some that don't. Our college, for example, we don't pay people who have master's degrees or PhDs more than we do people who are teaching in the trades, for example, because they have done, they're equally competent in their fields. And they've met the minimal qualifications, in many cases exceeded them. to be really good instructors of welding or, you know, computer applications or whatever it is they're teaching. Yes, no, there is not. And in fact, what they lose when they go on these leaves of absence is they lose 2 years of seniority if, you know, if they're gone for 2 years.
Any further questions, Representative Holvey?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm kind of curious. I've just anecdotally heard some things about some actuaries looking at the whole break in service issue and finding that it's actually more expensive to the state to manage this break in service issue than it would be not to have it at all. So I'm sort of curious about that as we go on. And I've also heard that there is an ability out there that some can actually manipulate this break in service system and have several breaks in services and have actually economically benefit by having so many different plans, I guess, essentially. I don't know if you have any knowledge of that. I don't know that I believe everything I hear. But.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Representative Holdy, I would just turn it over to Steve Delaney to talk about the numbers. He certainly is much more knowledgeable about particular instances and circumstances. I've heard some of those anecdotes as well of people actually benefiting from receiving a break as well because of the nature of OPSERP and the individual account program. But all of that is anecdote. I don't have any firsthand accounts of any of our members doing that. So.
And obviously, we're going to need a lot of hard numbers on this before we even think about making any decisions on this. And I don't think Mr. Delaney didn't sign up to testify today, so I'd assume that he's not prepared to answer.
I do have some.
Okay. Well, let's get the expert up here and see what he has to say.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, gentlemen.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, it's my apologies. The reason I didn't sign up is the PERS board has not taken a position on this bill, so I was available to answer questions you may have on the technicalities of the bill, but I'm not here to take a position either pro or against the bill. Just to give you some brief background and then talk about the numbers based on what I've heard here so far. This bill actually, the concept actually began this past summer by the PERS board itself when it was looking at ways to try to simplify the plan, because the PERS plan is a very complicated plan. Eliminating break and service would be one way that we would simplify it. But what would it cost? That was clearly a concern to the PERS board, and because it would also impact benefits, they decided ultimately not to introduce the bill, deciding that the policymakers had to determine if this was a bill that was worthwhile moving forward. What we've found in costs are two things. We had two questions, of course. What is the impact upon employers and their employer rates? The second question is, what was the impact on administration cost to PERS? The fiscal impact, we did send this concept because the board was developing it in the summer. So in April of 2006, we received a letter from Mercer indicating that...
Mercer is
our actuary. And my apologies, I'm not sure if I even identified myself.
Go ahead, do it again.
Steve Delaney, Deputy Director of PERS. So Mercer is our private actuary that does all of these kinds of number crunching for PERS. And they indicated that eliminating break in service would cost employers 0.01% in their rate. So 0.01% is what it would cost. It's in essence what is being saved by having break in service in place. Now, they did caution. The reason that you're hearing these stories that some people can actually do better under break in service is because with reform, you'll recall the PERS has two ways of calculating benefits, money match, which is your account balance annuitized over your lifetime, or a formula, which is your years of service times a factor. When you take your account balance and annuitize it over your lifetime, if you left today or if you stayed and kept working 8 years from now and then retired, it'd be the same amount because your account grows at the PERS assumed rate of 8% whether you're working or not. Because you recall that reform limited how much PERS could distribute to members' accounts to 8%. So in essence, there's no further cost to those members that are money matched. So they're zero cost to the employer until the time they retire. Now, if they have a break in service and come back, there's now a cost to those zero-cost employers for those employers because they now have to start contributing into the optional the Oregon Public Service Retirement Plan, what's often called Tier 3. So they would get their money match benefit and they would get an OPSERP pension benefit on top of that. that could actually then, that's where you hear this story, that it could actually begin to cost employers break-in service. The actuary estimates, now in this letter they don't give an actual number. They simply indicate that the cost of those rehires would be greater and would impact employers. They say the average rate or benefit increase, if you got rid of break-in service, for the average member, the benefit increase is about 3.4%. But for those people that actually do better, these money matchers that go out, come back, and get an officer pension, their benefit would go up about 11%. So that spread is what employers would have to be covering if indeed a sufficient number of people. You'd have to get enough people doing this for it to actually move a rate in one way or the other. So there was a caution. 0.01% is what it costs you to do away with break-in service, but it may actually be costing you some small percentage point anyway by keeping break-in service because of this ability for persons to be able to raise a greater benefit. Now, the full story, of course, is that money match is going away over time. So when you get out to the period where people start moving from money match into formula, then there are some greater savings to employers. Mercer doesn't give a number to that, simply indicates it's a very small amount, and it will be on a very small group of people because the number of PERS Tier 1 and Tier 2 members are getting smaller with each year as they retire. So when you get rid of money match in your formula, someone such as myself probably, there's just fewer of us by that stage, and so the amount of savings would be less. To your point, Chair Schaffler, clearly there are some additional numbers to crunch on this, but the indication from the actuary is we're talking very tiny swings one way or the other as far as impact. Administratively, you heard the discussion about PERS. Someone mentioned the $600,000. We have programmed into our computers this ability to now track break-in service. So if we get rid of break-in service, it will cost us about $600,000 to undo what we put into our computers. But, on the other hand, if we no longer have to do that work, we begin saving money on into the future because we have a backlog of about 3,000 accounts that have experienced a break of more than 6 months. Are they break-in service members? We don't know because there's so many exceptions to the break-in service rule. We have to contact the employer on each one to determine if they're one of the exceptions or not to the break-in service before we can complete their account construction. So you get rid of that work, and that saves us about $300,000 over the next two biennium. Kind of then makes a wash of the computer change to the work we have to do. And ongoing, we have estimated that into future bienniums, on into the future, it is $250,000 a biennium on into infinity by eliminating break-in service because of the complications it causes and the many contacts we have from employers trying to figure out whether or not a member has had a break-in service, what are the implications. Those sorts of things will go away without it. So there's a lot of information. I'm certainly available to answer questions and try to clarify.
If you add in all the little nitpick and fixes we're going to do every biennium from here on out, which is what we'll probably end up doing. How do you calculate that? I guess in the end, to get anything like this happen, we're going to need, how much is it going to cost this year, next year, and 25 years out? What kind of impacts have on the pension fund? And I don't even know how you can calculate all that. But I'll just open it up to, you can respond to what I said.
Mr. Chair, again, you're correct. Like you said, there's just a lot of assumptions they have to go on. It was helpful to them to know that we had 3,000 rehires that told them that there's about a 1% turnover a year in PERS membership that would face a possible future break in service if they were to return.
I think I'm going to hand it over to you until I quiet down. Thank you.
Steve, could we not have prevented this backing up of 3,000 employees if we would have had, before the employee ever left our service, some kind of a determination of whether that individual would be, one, eligible to come back with an exception, or two, was not eligible, and entered it in at that time?
Chair Scavelli, that does help us, and as in fact is one thing that is happening now. The 3,000 is a backlog. We don't have as many backlogs on an ongoing basis because employers tend to call us now as it's occurring, saying this member is getting ready to leave, this is their plan, does it look to you like they'll have a break in service? That's if they know what their plans are. Of course, we'll still have the backlog of those that leave, don't really know what their plans are, and return at a later date. But to the extent that we're able to get information to the employer ahead of time and note it in our files, yes, that is a help.
Yes, Representative Berger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Steve, what are the exceptions now that are written in?
They're actually in your bill. There's a series of them. You have family leave. You have sabbatical. You have, let me just take a look here, service as a member of the Legislative Assembly. A disability retirement. These are the sections that are going away in your page 2 of your bill. If you got rid of break in service, you wouldn't need all these exceptions. Okay. So lines 2 through 25 there.
I can read them myself. So let me get to my question. Are these currently... I know that PERS used to have a website that was pretty good about informing people about these kinds of things. Is this posted on your website for people who are contemplating, say, academic leave or something that would give them a clue as to what the exceptions are and what, and then by derivation, if you're not on that list, there's no exception?
Mr. Chair, Representative Berger, we do have information on our website. I will say the complication that makes it difficult for members tends to be concentrated in the education arena because of school districts only being in session 9 months out of the year. And so the Oregon statute recognizes that and doesn't expect 3 months of the year to be served by those members, and that doesn't impact them in any way. So it has been a real complication for education employees to try to figure out how that 3 months that doesn't impact them plays into the 6 months that they can't be gone without losing service in the system. And so we get some things that no matter what you put out on your website simply will not answer that. So we have had a staff member dedicated to answering those particular questions coming in from the education arena. But we do have information on the website to assist where we can for the bulk of our general service members.
Thank you, Representative Holby. Have a question?
I just wanted to, Representative.
No, I'm done. I'm thinking.
I just wanted to go back to something you said. I was just trying to follow all these costs to the employers and the savings. And by the time you got done, I kind of heard that it basically washed out, but the savings of administering, going a few years out and on down the road, that there actually would be an economic benefit back to the PERS system by eliminating the break in service. Did I hear that wrong when you were talking about the savings of the administration going into perpetuity at some point? That's going to pay. It's going to be cheaper to the PERS system to eliminate the break in service.
Chair Shockley, Representative Holby, yes, that is correct. For PERS administrative costs, we can definitively say into the future there is a savings by eliminating break in service. Again, the balance for a lot of decision makers is the employer rates, where it's less certain. I mean, we certainly indicate it's a small impact, but whether or not it's a savings versus a cost in the future is a harder one to call. But for administration charges, yes.
Representative Rosenbaum.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Steve, I remember hearing shortly after these reforms passed that there were situations where in some bargaining units, people would go on leave of absence to serve full-time as a union official, and that they were actually, by virtue of being gone, being bumped out of their PERS category. Has that already been corrected in some other way, or how would that be affected by this?
Chair Schaffler, Representative Rosenbaum, I understand the issue because we've had them in the past, even before break in service. There was always the question of whether service was being rendered to the employer by those individuals when serving as a union representative. It's not addressed specifically as an issue within the break in service statute. So it'd be more a question. I do not have the answer right now, but can get it for you as to whether the general per statute addresses service while serving as a union representative.
Thank you.
Any more questions? Okay, well, I just want to... Are you, Mr. Delaney, are you going to do some math on this? Or how does this all work? We need some real numbers. Otherwise, I don't feel comfortable doing it anymore. Conceptually, I agree. I think it makes sense. I think it's fair to the worker. But I don't want to go up some big hill just to have somebody come in here and wet all over what we're going to do for whatever reason, especially in light of the fact that we may have increasing rates by the employer, and that would definitely cause a lot of angst, a lot of people, and I think that may have real problems getting through this building. So,
Representative Shoffler, what I can do is, we've got, as I say, we've got our administrative costs. We have these letters from the actuary, which tend to be an actuary's. I can put together a summary document in just kind of basic language as to what it's saying about employer rates, administrative rates, and provide that to the committee and let the committee determine where you want to go from there.
All right. Representative Berger, would you like to comment on something?
I just am asking, Mr. Chair, if maybe legislative fiscal could be brought into the system.
The more the merrier. Many hands make for easy labor. So, yes. All right, then. Thank you very much. I don't see anyone else signed up to testify on House Bill 2623. Would anyone else like to testify? Yes, sir. Come on up.
Thank you, Chair Shoffler. For the record, my name is Steve Bryant. I'm the Interim Legislative Director for the League of Oregon Cities. I'm here today representing the PERS Employer Alliance. Two experts on this, Jim Green with OSBA, apparently didn't take his flu shot.
Neither did I.
I'm sorry. And Maria Keltner was not able to be here today either. I'll be brief. I want to express appreciation for the concerns that committee members have already raised about the bill and its potential impact on employers. That naturally is our concern. I listened with open ears to what was just said and appreciate the fact that you're looking for more fiscal information. We would just ask that you keep us in the loop. Our preference as we initially looked at this bill is to continue to work around the edges. If there are exceptions that need to be inserted into the break in service to fix some of these anomalies, I think we prefer that route. It's easier for us to deal with because the fiscal impacts of those, such as the period of time for continuing education, military leave, those kinds of things, are much more predictable and easier for us to work with and explain to our employees. So I believe that's our preference, but we'll be very interested in seeing what the fiscal impacts are that you come up with, and we'd like to stay involved in the dialogue. So,
Representative Esquivel.
Yes, you just mentioned military service. Isn't there better requirements on military that,
yes, I mean, Mr. Chair, there is. I heard in earlier testimony some comment about that, and I see it's not listed as one of the exceptions here. It might be helpful to have it listed here so that it parallels federal law. I was puzzled when I was reading through the bill that I didn't find it listed in these exceptions. And it does require the person who's looking at this statute to try to match up federal requirements with the break in service provisions.
Any further questions of Mr. Bryant? All right. Thank you, sir. Anyone else for this bill today? All righty then. I'm going to close public hearing on 2623. And I'm going to jump out of order a little bit and open a public hearing on House Bill 2446. And I'm going to call... Oh, Representative Cameron, come on up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, State Representative Kevin Cameron, House District 19, and I'm here because I know we had a short public hearing on this, and you wanted to have another public hearing and answer any questions you may have. I don't have any new information.
Okay. Any questions for the good representative while he's here? All righty then. Well, that's pretty easy.
Let me have something. Let's make something up.
Make something.
Make it hard.
What's the suit downstairs today? All right. Well, thank you, Representative. I guess that's all we need from you today. It's still a good bill should pass, right? All righty then. Marcia Mantos, I hope I got that right, Marcia, forgive me, and Joanne Cato and Andrew Preble, please. So, Marcia, forgive me.
I spelled, said your name wrong.
Marcia Matoso.
Oh, Matoso. Forgive me, please. Go right ahead.
For the record, my name is Marcia Matoso, and I am a marriage and family therapist and also certified gambling addictions counselor. And I would like to address this bill, giving my professional opinion, and also I'm representing the providers in Oregon for gambling treatment. Dear honorable representatives, my name is Marcia Matoso, as I said, and I have given over 8,000 counseling hours to gamblers and their families. Thus, hearing about this current proposal, HB 2446, has raised my concern for Oregonians. In my practice, I have heard from hundreds of pathological gamblers that availability of video lottery terminals was the main factor they became addicted to gambling. Some clients have told me that they were even considering moving to another state where these devices were not so readily available. My concern is also based on the facts below. Out of 1,700 receiving publicly funded treatment in Oregon, 18% indicated suicidal thoughts, and up to 10% attempted suicide. Average individual gambling debt was about $23,000. The combined debt from gambling was over $27.6 million. 60% jeopardized or lost a significant relationship or job because of gambling. And over 23% committed illegal acts to obtain gambling money. And 20.4% had alcohol problems. There are presently 74,000 problem pathological gamblers in Oregon. Thus, the passage of this bill could substantially increase that number. Gambling is growing faster than the system for treatment of gambling addiction. Therefore, my suggestion would be, before Oregon increases the number of video lottery terminals, please consider expanding the gambling treatment and prevention program. I would urge you to think about the impact this bill could have on the Oregon population and realize that fewer VLTs could save Oregonians thousands of dollars as well as prevent people from serious mental health, financial, legal, and relationship problems. Thank you. And if you have any questions, I'll be glad to answer them.
Thank you. Ms. Cato, you want to go ahead?
My name is Joanne Cato. I'm one of the pathological gamblers that Marcy has helped. I started gambling socially. I put a few bucks in here and there, would go to Reno and have a set amount of money to spend on a vacation. I stayed out of the video poker machine dens, and evil as I call them, for a long time, and unfortunately I stepped into one and I started gambling, and it took me about 6 months to become a compulsive gambler. After that 6 months, I had no control on anything I did when it came to those machines. The more machines that are out there, the scarier it is. Had they not been so readily available, I don't think I would have started gambling again. Unfortunately, every corner, every other building on the corner has our fingers in the cross signal like this, telling me how lucky I'm going to be. On May 15th, I ran away from home, and I was going to kill myself. My children convinced me not to do that. I was lucky I had kids that loved me enough to convince me I shouldn't. There are a lot of women and men in this state that don't have my kids and are going to end up either killing themselves, committing a crime, or hurting somebody else. I just hope you stop and think before you guys say we need more video poker machines, because they're so plentiful out there. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Preble.
Yes, thank you. My name is Andrew Preble. I'm a compulsive gambler. I prefer compulsive as opposed to pathological, because it is a compulsion. It's just as strong or stronger than alcoholism or drug abuse. Gambling video poker has been called by people that are in treatment the crack cocaine of gambling. So that should give you an idea of exactly what it does to people. I personally am actually a tables game gambler, so the video machines are not the bug for me. I do know of many people, however, that it is. I do know that if you add more machines and add more machines and add more machines, you will have many, many more people have problems with gambling. that the people that are compulsive gamblers affect more than just themselves. They affect their family, their wives, their children. They affect businesses when they go bankrupt. And many compulsive gamblers have gone bankrupt. They affect the West Lynns of the community when the people that are handling their money embezzle money out of their communities, out of the cities. They affect little leagues. They affect Boy Scout leagues. I mean, how many papers have we read about a person who has taken money, embezzled money out of Little League and Boy Scout troops and whatnot? And every time I see one of those stories, I say, you know, within a day or two, we're going to find out that where that money went to gambling. And in almost every case, that's exactly what has happened, that it goes to gambling. You know, and as far as expanding it into places that have alcohol, there's a reason that Nevada and New Jersey and the casinos give booze away for free. The reason for that is because the more you drink, the more you're going to gamble. You know, if you're making it more accessible and making it more accessible in a place where alcohol is available, all you're going to do is have a dramatic increase in the people that have these problems. You know, I personally, you know, if you go to an Indian casino, again, I'm a casino gamer, so I'm different. If you go to an Indian casino, at least they don't even allow alcohol on the floor, so that should give you a little bit of an idea as far as what's going on with them. I think that, you know, if you take a look at it, I don't have the exact figures, but something along the lines of 20% of the gambler supply, 50% of the income. So you can take a look at that and realize that a very few people are who is funding this. The only people that really benefit from gambling are the people that own the gambling machines. If you go into a Sherry's to eat dinner, to have a bite to eat, now the first place that they'll try to seat you is closer to the gambling room, because they have a gambling room over in the corner there. So if there's any tables over there, they'll try to steer you in that direction. The reason they try to steer you in that direction is because they want you to walk in there and they want you to gamble. I owned a tavern quite a few years ago. And when I owned my tavern, I had to make my money on selling beer and making good sandwiches and good soup. Their tavern owners now, they don't care if they sell anything, any food at all. Because what they want to do is, I know a man that owns three different taverns, okay? He doesn't care if he ever sells a sandwich or a beer, because he's going to make his money on the lottery. I have a friend of mine that actually moved to Virginia. He was for those of you that might be aware of 12-step programs, I was his sponsor. He actually wound up moving to Virginia, and the reason he moved to Virginia is because in Oregon he couldn't get away from the gambling. Plus, if he drank at the same time, he would go in a place where he would go for 30, 60, 90 days and without gambling, and then he'd go out and have a few beers, and the next thing you know, he was begging for money to come up with money to go gambling. I mean, I would much rather see somebody that would step up to the plate and say, maybe what we should do in Oregon is not allow any more machines than what we have today, and if anything, try to reduce those. This state has gotten addicted to gambling itself. One of the places that we keep counting on money is in gambling. 3 or 4 years ago, when we came across a little bit of a crunch as far as the finances go, I mean, we always have a little bit of a crunch, one of the areas they looked to cut money was cutting it out of the gambling addiction programs. When the Oregon lottery first was presented to the people and voted upon, they said that 2% of the money would go towards a gambling addiction program.
Mr. Preble,
that has never happened.
We're talking about putting lottery machines in a few more pubs.
Exactly.
And we're not hearing about gambling in Oregon. We're not saying yes or no on gambling. So if you want to summarize in a minute about this bill, I share some of your concerns about gambling in Oregon.
Well, then,
if you want to summarize what this bill.
Sure, I apologize.
No, that's okay. Don't worry about
it. All that I was saying then is what this bill is doing is allowing more machines in the state.
That's what it does.
Okay? If you allow more machines in the state, you're going to allow more. It's going to bring more problems to the state. You know, and it's just the next step. You know, what's the next place that we're going to allow more machines in?
And someday we may have a discussion about the state-sponsored lottery here in the state of Oregon, but that's not what we're doing today.
I understand. I guess
all due respect to the good people.
I guess, though, the reason is important is understanding the problems that it's created so far. So now if you open up more facilities, all you're going to do is increase the problems with the problem gamblers.
Can I add one more thing?
Yes.
To let you guys know that it's not just a small amount. Probably in 3.5 years, I lost my family's home. I gambled my family home away that my kids grew up in. We went into debt, approximately $750,000. So even one more machine to me is a big deal.
Right, I can appreciate that. Any questions for these good people?
Representative Rosenbaum.
Mr. Chair, not a question. I do appreciate your testimony and the comments about how, you know, it does seem like every time you turn around, there's another incident, and where there's a large amount of money, it very often is related to this. And in fact, if you look at today's paper, there's a story about a union official, somebody I happen to know, actually, and thought highly of, who had gambled, I think, up to $500,000 of a fund that was collected for the expenses of employees to take care of elderly family members and children. And so I think it's very true that it's a huge problem for some people.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks for your time.
Mr. Perry, would you like to come and speak to this bill?
For the record, Bill Perry with the Oregon Restaurant Association, and very, very quickly, this bill I don't think is going to expand any more machines. The issue that's being addressed here is that because you weren't allowed to, when they consolidated the license, they did not include brew pubs. There are 22 brew pubs out there, a very small number, that have to buy. Your first liquor license is $400. Your additional liquor license is $250. So they just have to get an additional $250 liquor license to get lottery. They're saying, which was the example that he came earlier and said, that, you know, I just don't really want to have to buy the second one because it doesn't do anything for me. You know, I don't meet different requirements or anything else. It's just an additional hoop I've got to jump through. And so I would say that, you know, this is not going to expand because they can already get them. They just have to pay $250 extra today. And so it's not going to expand more retailers from my standpoint. And I think that if you truly believe that that's true, I wouldn't support the bill because I don't think that's what it does. This has just been a specific example. A few small microbreweries had, and they asked us to come and say, could you just make it so I don't have to buy two licenses to accomplish the same thing? So with that, I'd be happy to answer questions.
Any questions for Mr. Perry? All right. Thank you very much. Anyone else like this testify to House Bill 2446? All right, I'm going to close the public hearing, and I'm going to open a work session on House Bill 2446. And I will entertain a motion. Representative Esquivel?
Yes, I moved that we forward 2446 to the House floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Esquivel moves House Bill 2446 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there a discussion? Representative Berger?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I'm sympathetic to the testimony of the folks who've had a terrible time with gambling addictions. It is a serious problem in our I kind of look at this. There's a river of gambling, and we're maybe possibly tossing a cupful into that river. But I am persuaded that what this really is a regulatory cleanup that we need to do. And in some other venue, in some other time, we need to address the gambling issues around things in this state. Thank you.
Thank you. Well, seeing nobody else, I just have to put my two bits in, too. I agree. I mean, there's no denying there's a problem with gambling in this state. And if I were king, I could wave a magic wand, I'd get rid of the state-sponsored lottery. That being said, this state's hooked on it like heroin. If we didn't have that money now, God knows what the budgetary conversations would be like. And this is in my opinion, just like the bill today on the floor, in my humble opinion, we're cleaning up some regulatory language and simplifying some things that just were overseen when we got in there. With all that, Kristen, would you call the roll, please?
Aye.
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 No.
Smith.
Excuse?
No.
Aye. The motion carries, and while we have him in the room, I was wondering if Representative Cameron would carry this one today. I'm glad you stayed. All right. Thank you very much. I'm going to close the work session on House Bill 2446, and I will encourage everyone concerned with this to follow this bill and do everything they can to make it better or whatever their desire may be, because it's nothing's a slam dunk in this bill. All right. Very good. Thank you. I would like to open a public hearing on House Bill 2250.
pre-session?
Yes, Mr. Chair. House Bill 2250 was pre-session filed on behalf of the Department of Consumer and Business Services. It allows DCBS to approve imposing a surcharge on a workers' compensation rating plan for an assigned risk pool. This option could be employed when to offset charges if other pricing mechanisms do not address plan shortfalls. We first heard this bill on January 26, and there's no revenue or fiscal impact.
Thank you. And there's no one to sign up for to testify to House Bill 2250 today. Would anyone like to testify to this bill? All right. Well, with that, I'm going to close the public hearing on this House Bill 2250 and open a work session on House Bill 2250. Representative Escobar.
Yes, Mr. Chair, I make a motion that we move House Bill 2250 to the House floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Esquivel moves House Bill 2250 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Representative Berger?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I had some qualms about this bill when it was first introduced. I've had my questions answered. I'm in support of this bill, and thank you.
Very good. Any further discussion? Seeing none, Kristen, you call the roll, please.
Aye.
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 Excuse?
Aye.
Aye. Motion carries. Do we want someone to carry this, or does this merit the consent calendar? How do you all feel about it?
If the word surcharge says...
Right. Would anyone like to volunteer to carry this bill?
I'll carry it.
Representative Berger, God bless you.
I volunteer, Representative Berger.
All right, very good. Representative Berger will carry this. I'm going to close the work session on House Bill 2250. And... open a public hearing on House Bill 2258. Teresa?
Yes, please. Mr. Chair. House Bill 2258 requires employers who have made payroll errors or underpayment to pay the employee within a certain time frame after a notice was issued. And in front of you, committee members, is a -1 amendment. It's a committee amendment that was drafted after the input from stakeholders and committee members at the first hearing on February 7th. The amendment establishes that if the error or underpayment is less than 5% of the gross pay due to the employee, it must be corrected no later than the next regularly scheduled pay date. And if the percentage is 5% or greater, it must be resolved with the employee within 3 days after the employer is given notice of the unpaid amount, with weekends and holidays excluded from that account.
Thank you. No one signed up to testify to House Bill 2258. Would anyone like to testify today? Does anyone have any questions about this bill? We have the wonderful people from the department here.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Esquivel.
I believe that we pretty well hashed this thing over last time. And I mean, how much can we beat the dead horse?
You've convinced me, Representative. I'm going to close a public hearing on House Bill 2258 and open a work session on House Bill 2258.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Berger.
I move that the -1 amendment to House Bill 2258 be incorporated.
Representative Berger moves the -1 amendments be adopted into moved into 2258. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? So moved.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Berger.
I move House Bill 2258 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative,
as amended.
Representative Berger moves House Bill 2258 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Kristen, please.
Aye.
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 Oh, excuse.
Aye.
Okay. Oh, what did you say, Mr. Chair? She called on
me. Aye. My vote doesn't count.
Yep.
It's already won. Doesn't matter who I vote.
Waiting for the other shoe to fall.
All right. This bill, do we want to... put this one on. We probably should. Someone should carry this. Anyone want to carry this?
Yeah, I volunteer on the last one.
Anyone like to carry this bill on floor?
No, Representative Holden. I'd love to.
Very good. Okay, I'm going to close the work session on House Bill 2258. Anything for the good of the order? All right, we adjourn.
I carried it for you.